the occupation is trying with all its might to break our hearts and to break us. A person has moments of sadness, and this is normal, but the fighter is the one who turns the sadness into victory. And we are fighters for freedom. We rejoice and we grieve, but we don't break.
Welcome to Blueprints of Disruption. I am your host, Jessa McLean. What you just heard was a message sent to our next guest, Anna Littman, from her friend in the West Bank. She shared it with us for the same reason it was sent to her, to acknowledge shared grief, while also demanding resilience from one another. Continued resistance. We cover a lot in this episode with Anna. She'll introduce herself in a moment. We start off, though, by talking about the expansion of illegal settlements in the West Bank and the violence Palestinians are subjected to there, both by settlers and the occupation forces. We, of course, talk about Auda Hathleen and how the details around his murder, although deeply personal to Anna, do serve as a case study of how ethnic cleansing is happening outside of Gaza. Together, we wonder what this means at a time where G7 countries, some of them, including Canada, are talking of recognizing Palestine as a state, which is also happening while hundreds and hundreds of activists are being arrested for supporting the very same thing. It's all very confusing, perhaps overwhelming, so we do our best to make sense of some of it, to find the bright spots, and to emphasize the impact the movement is having on our politicians, as well as the global position on Palestine. Be sure to check out the call to action for this episode. As always, it's in the show notes. This one is a fundraiser. We really are encouraging people to do what they can with. Donate or share. It all helps. Our show will be putting half of this month's existing or new subscriptions towards supporting Auda's family, who we get to hear much more about now. Anna Littman is back in the studio. Welcome back, Anna.
Thank you, as always, for having me.
It's not an easy time to be doing what you're doing, so I appreciate you taking the time to come in and talk to us. Anna, in case anybody's missed, like, I don't know, the half dozen times you've joined us, who are you?
Who am I?
So existential question.
I organize with Labor for Palestine, Independent Jewish Voices here in Canada. I've gone to Palestine, East Jerusalem, the West Bank a few times to do solidarity work there, and you know, just out here doing my best for Gaza, like we all are, you know.
And then some, Anna. Not just Gaza, but also the West Bank.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's primarily what we're going to talk about. Anna, like she said, she's been there a couple times, but probably more than a couple times. But it's been in the news more so, which is good and bad. It means like things are escalating, bad things are happening, but it also means it's getting the attention it deserves as well. Obviously, we're focused on Gaza for obvious reasons, but it's just a different form of ethnic cleansing happening over in the West Bank, almost using like the old school pattern of original settlements, you know, of just taking or buying, is how some people will frame it, parcels of land and creating illegal settlements bit by bit. The confrontations have been increasing. Am I correct in saying that? Like, would you say it's escalated since this infamous date we all have to reference now, since October 7th?
It's escalated so much since October 7th, but honestly, I think even in the last year, in the last 6 months, it's escalated more than anyone could have imagined. But that's what we're seeing in Gaza too, right?
More than anyone can imagine, absolutely. Yeah, and it kind of, you know, really maybe hit home. Not that it doesn't all, but very recently, Auda Hathleen.
Yes, excellent.
Was murdered by an Israeli settler. I've seen the video on camera that Auda filmed himself. I hope you haven't watched that. But yet the Israelis took his body. And I originally reached out to you because there had been an action plan to have his body returned. So not only do you want to just explain a little bit whatever I am missing on that, and then we'll talk about just the broader implications and what this is kind of very reminiscent of in terms of how they're annexing the West Bank.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wish this was an incident that was unusual instead of like a perfect case study of what's happening in the West Bank. So first, let me talk about Aldo a little
Please.
Bit, because I'd be doing him an injustice if I didn't. Auda, I had the privilege of knowing for only like 3 years, 31 years old, big major figure in his village, Umm El Khair, an activist, not by choice, but by, you know, his identity, but also an English teacher. He was a father of three young kids. He leaves a widow behind who's 24 years old. He was such a light in the village. And just to be clear, like, the village is a place where literally, like, Auda has 17 brother and sister-in-laws. He has, like, you know, 15 brothers and sisters himself and, like, 100 cousins. And they all live in this village, right? So it's really, like, his entire family. So on July 28th, Auda actually sent out a text to a bunch of internationals that morning being like, settlers are coming. They're bringing machinery. They're trying to cut the water. We won't have water in our village. You know, please contact your congresspeople, your MP, whatever you can do. And then the next update we got from comrades on the ground there is that Auda had been shot in the chest, I think, in the lungs, in the ambulance ride to the hospital. He didn't make it. He died in the ambulance. And, you know, let's be clear, it's not a settler that murdered him on video. We know his name. His name is Yinon Levy. We know where he lives. Well, I don't, but it's written down somewhere. Everyone else knows.
He's been sanctioned, right? Like, this is not just someone known to you in the circles.
He has been sanctioned Canada, UK, US under Biden, and the EU. He has an illegal outpost that's a farm. We know everything about him. We have so many different angles of the video of him shooting. And mind you, when he shot Auda, Auda was standing in the community center basketball court. He was surrounded by his mom, by young kids, by, you know, international activists. And Yinon was just shooting into a crowd of Palestinians, right? Prior to Auda being shot, Yinon knocked his cousin unconscious with the bulldozer, whatever.
Yes.
And that's actually what had people trying to stop, you know, and say, stop, like, we don't want this violence in our community. And Auda died defending the human right of water for his community, for his children, for his mother, his children, I said that, his cousins, you know. When the day that Auda died, his cousin who was knocked unconscious was arrested, as well as a couple other cousins. The day after, the two international activists, one a nurse and one a former army vet who gave him CPR and immediate medical treatment, were deported. That day as well, Yinon was sent to house arrest. That night, they raided the village and arrested all, like, in total, in two night raids, they arrested 20 of Auda's cousins. And then, you know, the day in between they did those two night raids, the courts decided that there was not enough evidence against Dinon to hold him. So he walked free. And then the day after that, as they're holding on to Auda's body, as the women in Umm Al Khair, including his wife, his mom, his sister, are on a hunger strike, asking for the body back from Israel, because they don't want to give it back unless he's buried in Yatta, which is the nearby city, and unless they do it in the night with 15 people. Again, Auda has more than 15 people in his immediate family, right? So the army, Israel held on to his body for 10 days and then finally allowed him to be buried in the master plan area of Umm Al Khair, which is technically a different place than the village of Umm Al Khair, but it's nearby and there's building allowed there. So they were allowed to dig his grave there.
When you say they allow building there, it's because they prohibit building in the actual village itself.
Exactly, because they don't have what's called a master plan. And they're technically...
We know the master plan.
Yeah. And all the buildings there are under demolition orders.
It's hard to imagine that after all we've seen that this still enrages me. You know, just hearing each individual story like this, but just... Because this is common too, right? Dictating how folks can grieve, holding the bodies of...
Absolutely.
Palestinian prisoners who've been... you know, arbitrarily detained in Israeli Zionist prisons. And, but I don't know, like we got to hear this story a whole lot more, thankfully, because of the international profile Auda helped create for himself, again, not out of choice, by out of duty, I suppose, in helping to create some of the footage or whatnot for No Other Land, which again, helped draw a little bit of attention, hopefully not away from Gaza, but while people are, you know, watching, showing exactly how they take bit by bit. And just through telling a bit of this story so far, I'm going to let you go on. I kind of interrupted you, but you've just given so many examples of control, denial, slow erasure. Like nothing like what we're seeing in Gaza, but like bit by bit, like you can't build here.
Yeah.
I can come and take your water at any time. Like we see that in Gaza too, but just through a different kind of settler violence, aided by the IDF. So you said they a lot, but I think because they seem one and the same, right?
They are.
Yeah. Yeah. The illegal outpost you talk about, Yinon Levy having, just brought up a point for me too, that in, I think, May of this year, 22 more settlements, you know, were approved or whatever, created by the Zionist government there. And, you know, when you see the locations, you can see them being even more bold with placing these. And some of the patterns are they set up an illegal outpost, which is then deemed legal through these constant creations of settlements. So I guess it was just me trying to draw in the geopolitical or helping understand how the Israeli government is creating these situations on purpose that then manifest themselves in,
right,
you know, horrific ways. But yeah, it's just like a sampling of what's been happening. But
it is.
So I imagine justice is being demanded. Are you expecting it? Like an arrest?
You know, the women of Umm Al Khair went on a hunger strike to demand Auda's body back because they wanted to give him a dignified burial that he deserved, right? I think that, you know, I would say I'm an abolitionist, but God, do I want justice? Do I want this guy behind bars, you know? And, you know, the women did not ask for that because I think they know a little better than me that that's not going to happen, right? But, you know, it's just so sick and maddening when they're trying to grieve after getting the body back and the construction that started the day that Auda was shot is being continued by Yinon and his friends. And then in the middle of their grieving, they finally cut the water line. So as they have Aoda's body back, they lose their water. And today, Yinon's brother-in-law, Issachar or something, was there this morning stopping them with the army from repairing the water, right? And so we want justice, but I think people who have never been to Palestine have never really like seen this level of oppression. Like, justice is really for them like dignity, agency, humanity. And I think for me, I would love it if they moved him to some other part of the West Bank or whatever, so he could not just stand outside Aoda's house and terrorize his children and widow as he's doing right now, right? And so, you know, God, I want justice so bad, but what does justice even look like in that situation, right?
I think you said it best that has very little to do with, you know, the IDF arresting or charging the Israeli courts, you know, trying to serve it up in that way. Those same courts just deem a lot of these settlements legal after a while, right? So, yeah, and I can understand that not being a big focus, considering the grand scheme of things, especially when you're in a situation where you're being encroached by settlers, attacked, and having your water cut off. Like, whether they arrest one of them or not really probably wouldn't impact your day, other than that personal kind of terror that you're talking about, you know, that repeats itself over and over. I said before we started recording, you know, trying to get people caught up on what's happening can be a little bit overwhelming. But at the same time, it's like, we can't stop talking about it, right? We can't stop updating people. So I do want to kind of get a little bit of your feedback on some of the developments. I don't know if I have a sufficient word to describe what seems to be hopefully a moment, like it seems more desperate. However, it seems really ramped up, for lack of, you know, like it's just everyone's focused on Trump and what he is doing, but also like on our end, which is somewhat related, you know, Netanyahu just announced what we have been telling everybody he was doing from the fucking get-go. I mean, Francesca Albanese is just had like the platform that she had, and she still, no one would listen, right? Like, it's just so very frustrating that he would completely annex and occupy Gaza, like again, or in a different form. And he can do this just like standing in front of the UN without getting arrested or laughed out of that space at the very least, or, you know, shunned in any way. It's like, it's appalling. But this is happening at the same time that, you know, he's facing a little bit of pushback. A lot of states are looking to recognize Palestine, finally. And I told this to my mom, I'm like, these are like the last ones, by the way. Like, when you look at a map of the world, most countries recognize Palestine. The UN recognizes Palestine. It's not really helping them much. I'm not going to deny them statehood, but I don't get super excited about the fact that like a couple more of the G7, these will be the first of the G7 to finally recognize Palestine. But it seems like a weird spot to be in, and I wanted to maybe check in with you. You seem to be obviously in the thick of it, and you're seeing people maybe celebrate like, oh, but Carney's going to recognize Palestine now, so we should kind of be grateful and see this as a positive sign. You can probably hear my skepticism. I'm trying my best. I'm not doing a very good job. How do you feel when you see that? So it's not just Canada, France, Australia, and the UK in September. It's got to wait till September for some reason. I'm not sure. That feels really nefarious to me. Like something's going to happen either before that or right after that. They've timed it together. What's going on?
Yeah. And I think there's some also conditions to recognizing it in September. Do you know them? I don't know.
I don't know all of them, but I do know they're looking to disarm
right.
they want a disarmed Zionist Palestine, right? So this is like theoretically a two-state solution, but really to me feels ill-defined, but maybe that's just because I haven't read enough. But I do know like that's a lot where my skepticism comes in, where they're trying to disarm the people undergoing a genocide and not those perpetuating it. But I was hoping you would help make it sense.
Yeah,
But it just doesn't make
it
sense.
doesn't make sense. I think like you're right. It's such an, it feels like such an overwhelming time. I think for those of us who haven't had to deal with, three generations of Nakba, we're not really prepared to see the world stay silent as this live streamed atrocity is happening, right? I think, of course, we can't lose hope, we can't stop. And we should see this movement by Carney, by these other countries as a ray that of hope that they're feeling the heat from us, right? But it's so beyond silly to talk about recognizing a Palestinian state right now in September on conditions. If I, a graduate student who's poor and living in a bachelor apartment can understand that Palestine will be ethnically cleansed by September if we just wait, how can Mark Carney and the world leaders stand there and say that they don't understand this, right? We have seen the amount of death that is happening not only in Gaza, but all over the West Bank, in East Jerusalem. We know that not only is this destruction happening to people, but it's happening to institutions. There's an immense fear, and rightly so, because anyone who is Palestinian in Palestine and saying something is going to be visited by the secret police, right? And so what does it mean to recognize a Palestinian state? Mind you, Gaza, West Bank, and East Jerusalem don't connect to each other. So, it putting aside the logic, what does it mean to declare a state when everyone who was part of that state has been killed already? And we are seeing right now the ramping up of this carnage. We've heard what Netanyahu said, and honestly, the things that are happening in the West Bank, they really feel worse and more urgent than they did 6 months ago, right? And I get the sense that Netanyahu and the Zionists and the Zionist Project are like, let's see how much of our plan we can get done by the, 6 month deadline that the world has decided to give us. And why do we think that's acceptable or anything to celebrate? It's something to build on and demand more of our government, right?
I think the timing of it was a little suspect as well, with the re release of the report. I think that was our last episode at this point. Or maybe have to go back 2 episodes to hear the folks, revealing the fact that while Carney has been telling us that, oh, we've got an arms embargo, sit down. Like I can picture him at that rally. He's done it a few times, though. They all have. And right when we're going, actually, here's the receipts. It was perfect timing for them to be like, okay, we'll recognize a Palestinian state at the same time, declare that these are essentially war crimes, right? Or gross violations of international law denying aid. I love how they're just so, I know we're in this, a starvation period, and like that is what you mean, like the end is seems so incredibly near. And but to just be focused on that and not the fact that,
We're sending them weapons to do it. Like, it doesn't make any sense, right?
yes, and we still are declaring that the occupation can stay, right? We're demanding even that Palestine come to the decision that we realize it's been an illegal occupation for 75 years, but we want out of this genocide, so we'll just have to accept that. Like I, it's incredible. Honestly, and I think a lot of Canadians are really struggling to grasp this because, I see a poll and it's talking about, who's going to call it a genocide amongst Canadian voters. And even though they're so fucking awful, I was still surprised that 51% of cons are like, it's not.
Wow.
Like, yeah, 51% of con voters are like, it's absolutely not. 7% of NDP voters say it's not a genocide, but 25% of them wouldn't commit to it either way, making it 32%, a third of NDP voters will not call it a genocide, despite everything available to them. But liberals had better numbers than the NDP, although 9% of them say this absolutely isn't a genocide, and we can see who they are, right? They've got a handful of MPs with following that are certainly perpetuators of this, but 17% of them only were unsure, yes or no. So, but 74% of them voted for a Liberal Party while saying this is a genocide. My government is complicit in it. My Liberal government is complicit, and I still went out and voted for them. 74% of them acknowledged that. I mean, maybe they won't acknowledge our role in it, but where do you think the Canadian public is at in terms of holding these politicians accountable? Do we anticipate people being placated by the Palestinian statehood? I do see it rippling amongst folks. Like, I'm getting a little bit of pushback going, you're never happy. You don't actually want peace there. You now you're just denying the most progressive thing to ever happen for Palestine in Canadian government. And I guess I'm always a critic, but I do worry that sometimes things like this, like the ceasefire, will have people thinking that they've got a government that's actually on our side or on the right side, and like they're fucking not, like not even fucking close to not. And we've laid it all bare for them. So I'm very frustrated right now with the state of the Canadian public to see those numbers. That's the first time you're hearing those numbers, yeah? It's just it's one of those Angus Reid polls. So, and everyone says you can't believe the polls and the numbers are skewed, but there's something there, 74% of liberal voters, you've got them calling it a genocide. Their government won't. So what? Like, are they not calling in? Like, that isn't enough pressure? Have we not created enough? What do we got to do?
And I mean, I think look at how far the Canadian government has come in the last 2 years, right? Like, whenever would our prime minister be talking about Palestine without before October 7th, right? Or even like be talking about anything but standing with Israel and defeating Hamas before 2024, right? And so we're nice Canadians, the liberals. Like we think like we vote, we say we don't like this, and Carney says, well, let's recognize a state. And that's all like so happy, right? But I think we have to remember one, like what this arms embargo report tells us, right? Like Carney says he's going to recognize a state, but he's also putting bullets on my commercial flights. Mind you, I'm not allowed to put like a battery pack underneath the cargo, but fine, right?
Or like water in a container. I haven't flown in a long time. I don't even know if that's still a thing, but it was like finding that out, I was shocked. Like not just a moral failure, but like, isn't that a safety issue?
It is, right? So, yeah, if that's not enough for the Canadian public, I think it's important to remember that like we in our own lives would never accept the bare minimum of what we deserve, right? And so why do we think it's okay to accept the bare minimum for Palestine? The bare minimum being feeding the people and not killing them, right? Like we here in Canada who take our healthcare for granted, who take all these things we get for granted, public parks, like do the children of Gaza not deserve a park and happiness above just being fed and kept alive, you know? Like,
no, Bob Ray would respond, what about the hostages? I don't want you to answer, like, I'm not asking you to answer that, but that's still, that was last week. They're still responding to, like, pleas from NGOs saying these people are starving. And he's going, yeah, but what about the hostages? One of the things, like, I get your, that it's a ray of hope. It is a sign that, like, we're forcing them to take stands they wish they never ever had to take. But at the same time, you know, talking to the authors of the report, one of the goals was like, create a political crisis. You know, they couldn't say that in their press conference, so they got to say it on our show. Like, that is their intent, is go with this, like, make them, I don't know, make it Carney resign, force an issue, force something so explosive that they have to really jump, not just give us incremental things. And anything that takes that heat off makes me mad, you know, like, even especially if it's crumbs, like statehood, like recognized by Canada, doesn't mean that it'll exist now, like it'll be realized and manifested, like what it means, like autonomy and sovereignty and self-determination. All that still won't exist for them. And yet I don't want to pull any heat off of it, right? Thank God people are still outside of Jolie's house. Honest, I know folks are like, oh, well, I've got NDP supporters coming at me going, well, shouldn't everyone live in peace and without harassment? And I'm like, no. While calling them, I'm not even going to name this person, but while labeling them as genocide supporters. So this person understands like that it's genocide happening, that liberals are perpetuating it, that they are genocide supporters. But yet they should be afforded a home that they can just lay their head peacefully every night and cash in their paychecks while being complicit in what we're watching in 4K. So then I get really upset about NDP partisans, and we won't go down that rabbit hole. But it still shocks me that, like, folks would still afford peace to people that are committing a genocide. But yet they would look back at the Nazis and say, oh, this is what I would do if I was living, and I would have done this, and I would punch a Nazi, and like, they've got the shirt, and it just doesn't manifest in real life for them, you know. But there is a lot of people pushing a lot of envelopes too, right? Like, people are risking it all. So that's not to say that there isn't successes being done and a movement being grown. Sometimes I forget to mention that while I'm talking about my dismay, but it is incredible to see, like, in the UK, for example, thousands upon thousands of people go into an action knowing, maybe they did it, I don't know, we could talk about that, that they would likely be arrested. They were challenging a new terrorism law that made Palestine Action a terrorist group, an entity, and that any public display, probably private, of this group is charged under the terrorism law with a possible 14 years in prison as the sentence. And so folks went in, sat cross-legged, wrote all the same thing on the placard. I know you know this, Anna. This is for anyone who might have missed it. You know, the sign said, I oppose a genocide, or the genocide, or just genocide. Not even the. It could be any. And I support Palestine Action. They hauled 500 of them away and charged them under the Terrorism Act. My mom said, but you said there were thousands there. Why didn't they all get arrested? And I was like, well, sometimes you can't get everyone to commit to an arrest, but they'll be there in a defiance, and maybe they'll leave on the first warning or second warning, or, you know, you need some people to do jail support. You need some people left over. And she's like, no, they should have all been arrested, you know? And I go, I get it. We'll get there. But, like, that's still incredible. You got thousands of people to risk. You know, they sent out, Anna, they sent out messages ahead of time saying, because they knew this was going to happen, right? This was planned. It was public. They had made calls, come here on August 9th, do this, challenge this law. And the police sent out a message as that if you got charged under this law, you possibly couldn't ever teach again, and you probably would never be able to travel to the U.S. again. So they use, like, every level of fear and intimidation, and then dedicated incredible police resources. I think, like, maybe they thought you can't arrest us all. You know, when you cross the street at, like, 30 of you at the same time, you're just like, well, the car has to stop. maybe they had that mentality, like, there's just no way. Maybe they'll pick a few of us off. But it's like, no, they're willing to just jam full their prisons to quell the issue. But make it make sense, Anna. They're doing this at the same time that they're going, we're going to recognize a Palestinian state. but don't support Palestine action. That's terrorism. Is this meant to just confuse the shit out of us and we just don't know which way to point?
We are experiencing levels of fascism in Europe, in North America, that are being exported from Israel, from Zionism, to keep us quiet because of this mass movement. Because when you see dismembered babies, it makes you want to do something, right? And they're losing the narrative. We see the shifting. And I think they're throwing anything at the wall that they can. You know, we've seen this with South Africa too, right? We ourselves, the people, have to push our governments and push our governments, and they will do everything they can to feed us crumbs and hope that will go away. And it's, you know, the UK, the people that put their body on the line, it's them that say no. Like, again, we want dignity, humanity, freedom for Palestine. You know, talk about terrorism. Like, again, South Africa. We know that terrorism is a social construct. It's
like all crimes.
Yeah, right? I don't think it's meant to make sense. I think it's meant to scare and intimidate people. And, you know, we don't want to be homeless. We like to keep our jobs. So it works when you're basing it all on, you know, the threat of kicking people out of capitalism. It's a big threat.
It is a big threat, especially when you have an economic crisis happening at the same time. But I feel as though intentionally, unintentionally, this issue has become an acceleration point for all of us, thankfully, right? It's obviously we have some building to do because they're like fucking foot to the floor at the moment, the fascists. Yeah, it's really swelled the ranks of the movement. And I think starting to reshape people's idea of, you know, what is acceptable forms of resistance as well. The amount of support for Palestine action, hopefully, you know, the Palestine issue is enough to draw people in. But once you start infringing on civil liberties at home, a whole new crowd will join in. Right? Liberals just hate that. Even if they just wanted to sit on Palestine, like whenever they are forced to do this, it triggers even more and more of a resistance from us. And there's just so many boundaries being pushed right now on indigenous rights at home. And I think you're just migrant rights, tenants. They're all kind of hitting this tipping point. I know there's a mass mobilization call coming up soon. I will. Thank you. The details will be in the show notes because I don't have them in my notes now, but it's like a convergence of different movements. It's really impressive to see. And I think that's being followed up by a date in September where they will come together into the streets. So again, I'll link that in the show notes, but like, that's what we need, right? You know, we've already been talking about 40 minutes, but I have to ask you, you know, where the fuck is labor? Not that it's your responsibility, but like, can we vent together a little bit? Or maybe you can give me some positive notes. And one positive note is I'm going to channel Rachel Small and the opportunity, she calls the discovery that, you know, a lot of the shops are Unifor shops, for example, that are making the arms. This is a great opportunity for Unifor to, you know, make that statement into action. How is that happening at the rank and file level? What's it feeling like for labor for Palestine right now?
You know, again, labor has such an important role to play that we saw from South Africa, that we've seen from all these struggles, right? And to me, it's no coincidence that Chris Smalls was on the last flotilla, right? Because if you want to bring labor and Palestine together.
Who better?
Exactly, right? Yeah, and so it's really important. And Labor for Palestine, we have this, and we're very happy to launch it around the arms embargo now stuff, a call for Hawk Cargo Kills campaign. This idea that we as Canadian labor, as Canadian workers, need to stop handling anything that has anything to do with Israel.
Yes, please.
Yeah. And you know, again, as you said, like we know from the Arms Embargo Now report what airports, what unions, all these bullets and other, you know, not real weapons
Components, non-lethal components.
are being sent out. But I think it's also really important to remember that BDS, boycott, divest, sanction, is a holistic movement, right? And so, like, no, we don't want to touch bullets or send bullets, but also, like, we need to stop bringing in Israeli oranges. Like, CUPW needs to stop touching mail from Israel, right? Like, these are the ways that these actual calls can be made into action, not just for that small sector that actually works at arms plants, but for everyone, right? Like, I will commit on camera right now, not that I have before, but you know, I will not teach any Israeli-based articles, anything like that in my classroom, right? That's my job as a teacher who believes in hawk cargo, right? And so really thinking about the ways that like you in your workplace can actionize this, because we can. It's not that hard, right? And it makes you feel good to do something.
And we're seeing like little snippets thanks to TikTok as well, like Israeli tourists being denied service. You don't have to be unionized to take part. There's many, many ways you can make it super uncomfortable for Israelis to be able to travel abroad. There's lots of examples of people doing that. And I think former IDF soldiers or vacationing or returning home IDF soldiers are getting even more nervous
Yes.
because of the amount of work being done by folks at like the Maple, where you can now find, I think it's identifyasoldier.net. It'll be linked to so many fronts, right? To add pressure on the Israeli people to create their own political crisis. But, in the end, would it still be a Zionist Israel? Like, it's such a mind fuck trying to find the end of the tunnel. And
Yes.
just so much coming at us at once, too. And I worry. I can't help but worry when I see, like, I don't mean to be such a downer, I'm sorry, but when I see the UK, I'm going like, that is not that far-fetched from happening here. The Sami Doan Network was declared a terrorist organization here in Canada, and I'm like on their mailing list. So I'm immediately thinking, okay, if I'm on their mailing list, I've got comrades definitely like working with them. What does that mean? What else could they do with that label? It could be aggravating factors in people's cases and all of this, just the way that they could weaponize that. And then you see, oh, well, there's another way it could be weaponized, like just voicing support for outlawed groups become a problem, and that can have a really chilling effect on people, or not, or not, right? Like, because there's so many great examples too of networks being created, and I know you're part of one of them, of folks who come together within around being arrested. The Toronto legal community support that goes on. Hopefully, it's not unique to Toronto, and it's being replicated. Just to ease the burden of being arrested. Or to find rays of hope within that kind of level of persecution, prosecution, both. I think if the cons were in power, I think if the liberals are pushed enough, it could be a tool, but liberals just don't, might not stand for it. But I could see the cons behaving like Starmer, which is ironically, not ironically at all, the Labour, the Labour Party. Like, is that's not a red flag for people right now? I don't know what is,
Right.
honestly, when it comes to electoral politics. But yeah, like you seemed astonished when I was like, is it 500? It was 500. Like, what number wouldn't have astonished you? Like, are you surprised by this level of police action in the UK? They're kind of digging in on this. Like, it had high publicity of 90-year-old women being hauled away by cops and, a blind man in a wheelchair. They had great are awful optics around this. And I think it kind of surprised me and the people I told about it that they had dared do this. You think there'll be enough blowback that they question doing this again?
I hope so. I mean, we have to look at what's happening everywhere else, right? Like, there was almost 20 people arrested at the last rally in Toronto, and we weren't even, like, you know, celebrating Sammy Doon or anything like that, right? Yeah, right?
I worried about that when I didn't hear from you this morning. You know, I was just like, oh no, I hope Anna didn't get arrested again. My mom's like, is she back from the West Bank? You know, and I'm like, yes, yes, but it doesn't mean she might not be waiting for bail right now. but yeah, like I joke, it is incredible though, the increase of arrests. And that it's not daunting anyone is the best part. Yeah. Is that where you were going?
Yeah. And I mean, like, if we don't get angry about the 500 people arrested in London, next month, there's going to be 500 people arrested in Toronto. Right. And, you know, think about things like, to me, like the bubble bylaw, these other things that are just such a curtailment of our basic civil liberties, the things that liberals, cons, anyone who says they're a proud Canadian holds up as like the light of what it means to live here, right? So, you know, I think these people really need to ask themselves, like, whatever your, frankly, whatever your position on Palestine is, like, you understand you'll be next unless you speak up, right?
Well, they're all up in arms. They, the right wing, you know, we use a lot of they. They're all up in arms because, you know, they can't walk in the woods in Nova Scotia or some shit. I don't know. I don't have the capacity for this, really. But they're like, he's a veteran. How dare you fine him for openly breaking the law? And I'm like, excuse me? What? Are you guys for real? Like, that's the right you're going to live and die by, to be able to walk through the woods? Go the fuck ahead then, you know? But the hill that they'll mobilize around is so manufactured. They say they understand that Canada's about freedoms. I hope you heard the facetiousness in my voice. But they don't act that way ever, right? It's the same on freedom of speech or, you know, freedom of expression here in Canada. Like, for me, not for thee, I think it's the expression. But yeah, eventually they're going to go too far because, you know, it's the same people too that are all up in arms about their convoy or ringleaders getting 7 years and shit. And but that's also why we caution. You say, even when I asked you about justice, like, I'm an abolitionist, right? We don't actually cheer for more arrests. Just a comment too about those terrorism laws made me think back, because I'm old enough to remember and to have been politically engaged when during 9/11 and the aftermath and the secret courts and the exceptions that were made for people charged under terrorism acts. And that makes me, like, you know, I know that there's this extra level. It's not just you're arrested, you may face 14 years and go through all the regular arrest nonsense, bail, outing, all that horrible stuff that goes with being arrested. But you fall under a completely different set of laws, and it's almost like your rights are completely stripped once you're charged under terrorism acts. I do worry about that, but I also feel like screaming at people, like, you supported that. Well, you thought that was kind of a Canadian thing, to protect our airports, to protect us from Islamic terrorists, right? Like, this was a valid reason to curtail all these rights. And this just feels a little like they're shaping it in the same package, right? It's still Islamic terrorists, right? That's the label. I'm sure you've been charged with supporting Islamic terrorism, right? Like, how many times? So the fact that it's packaged all the same way as 9/11 is troublesome to me, but I have a feeling this generation is way too savvy. Every generation younger than me seems to take less shit from the government. You know, mentally, they don't have as much deference each generation. So I am hopeful that they're just creating, like the circumstances for their own demise, right? You're just going to push too far. I think you have, right? Because you couple this with ICE, us having to see that and them experiencing it and all of the other, like, whoa, you went that far? Like, how? I hope I'm not being naive. I hope, like, yeah, they've just gone too far where people are like, no more. Yeah, so I hope that there's a lot of pushback to those 500 arrests in the UK, because if it just fizzles, that's a terrible precedent. we've kind of run the gamut too of like Palestine. I've made you talk about everything. We started off, you know, on the West Bank and specifically talking about Auda's case and his death, but ended up going a little bit of everywhere. Is there anything we didn't kind of bring up that you think folks should be paying attention to or knowing about?
Two things I'll mention. One, there is a fundraiser for Auda that I'm going to send you. That, and two, you know, I think because we've talked so much about just how terrible this moment feels, I wanna share a text that my friend who lives in the northern West Bank sent to me on Friday when I told him my heart was breaking over Auda. And I think he'd want everyone to hear it and to really heed it, you know? He says, "I understand, but you have to know something. The occupation is trying with all its might to break our hearts and to break us. A person has moments of sadness, and this is normal. But the fighter is the one who turns the sadness into victory. And we are fighters for freedom. We rejoice and we grieve, but we don't break." And, you know, if he can say that as the army is outside his door, to me that just felt really, really powerful.
Yeah, I got a little bit braver. That does mean something coming from somebody inside the occupation, you know, experiencing this firsthand, but you don't break. Don't you feel like you break a little every day, Anna?
More than anything. But, you know, when Ghassan says we can't break, I say you're right.
Just a little bit, right?
A little bit.
A little bit. But
we
then
put it back together with joy. We're normal, right? We are human. But, you know, I think, like, what, you know, what he's saying is, like, what the occupation wants is to rob us of our humanity and to break our hearts and part of the resistance. And, you know, I listened to Ahed Tamimi say this in a podcast, like, yesterday, you know, part of the resistance is not letting them take our humanity, not letting them take what makes us human and turning us into nothing better than them, right?
Auda said he wanted to see an end to the occupation without suffering, right?
Yes.
Yeah. He was described as a radical humanist.
Yes.
Amongst other things.
And, you know, one of the things that Auda always says is, you know, you can't give up hope. You can't live without hope because it's hope that keeps you going under such harsh conditions, right? And I know that Auda wants a better life, not only for his kids, but for all the kids in Palestine, right? And for that alone, I think that's what's gently little sewing my heart up, even though it is certainly cracked, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad you shared that too, because sometimes we're lacking in ways to mend ourselves as we break a little every day watching what we're watching, because yes, we absolutely can't lose hope. And I think any sign that you've lost hope is when you do stop. But I think there's a lot of us that as soon as that happens, it doesn't sit right. So rest becomes very difficult to get.
Yes.
You feel undeserving of it in a way. I think sometimes when I'm complaining about stupid stuff, I'm like, I am not dodging bombs and finding food for my children. I know my problems will still matter, but it really fucking puts things into perspective in terms of like what I'm capable to do with my energy in this moment. Because I'm not in that situation, like, at all. So yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, like, yeah, there's like biological needs that need to happen for us to function, and, you know, emotional ones too. So I very much appreciate you kind of coming in at a time where, you know, maybe this stitched you up a bit. Maybe I wasn't too much of a pessimist or asking hard questions, that this isn't something you have to recover from.
Not at all.
Thank you, Anna.
Always a pleasure.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. Please share our content, and if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content. So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.